A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's really two questions folded together. First, what does the media environment and freedom of expression actually look like in China today? And second, does China block foreigners who've criticized the Communist Party from entering the country? The second one's more straightforward than the first, but they're connected in ways that aren't obvious until you dig in.
The entry question. I want to start there because it's the one with a clear answer, and it sets up everything else. Yes, China absolutely blocks foreign critics from entering. This isn't speculation. There's a documented pattern stretching back years, and it's only gotten more systematic.
More systematic is doing a lot of work there. What does that actually look like?
The most famous case people know is the New York Times correspondents. In 2023, China expelled three of them. Austin Ramsey, Vivian Wang, and someone else, after their press credentials were revoked. They weren't accused of breaking any law. They had simply reported on things the government didn't like. And once you're on that list, you're on it. There was a Reuters piece last year about a BBC correspondent who tried to renew a visa in 2024 and was told, essentially, don't bother applying again.
It's not just journalists.
There was a case in 2024, a professor from Georgetown, specialist in Chinese labor movements, invited to a conference at Fudan University. No reason given. The conference organizers in Shanghai were apparently embarrassed because they'd invited him and then had to quietly uninvite him when the PSB, the Public Security Bureau, flagged his name. What's interesting is the mechanism. It's not that there's some master list published anywhere. It's that the entry-exit bureaus run names through internal databases, and if you publish criticism, if you've signed certain open letters, if you've testified in front of Congress about Xinjiang or Hong Kong, your name gets flagged.
It's a blacklist that doesn't officially exist.
And that's the point. There's no law that says foreigners who criticize the party shall be denied entry. There doesn't need to be. The system is designed to be opaque, so there's nothing to challenge in court. You just don't get your visa, and nobody has to explain why.
Which is a very Chinese way of handling it. Don't write the rule, just build the filter.
The filter is getting more sophisticated. There was a Wall Street Journal report in early 2025 about how the National Immigration Administration has been integrating social media scanning into its vetting process for visa applicants. If you've posted criticism of the party on Twitter or LinkedIn or wherever, that can now factor into the decision. It's not automated in the sense of an algorithm just rejecting you, but there are review queues where flagged applicants get extra scrutiny.
We've moved from don't say this while you're in China to don't have said this ever, anywhere.
That's the shift that really matters. 10 years ago, the bargain was basically, you come to China, you don't cause trouble while you're here, you're fine. Foreign correspondents operated under that understanding for decades. You'd self-censor a bit, you'd avoid certain topics, and you'd keep your visa. Now the bargain is, we will check what you said before you even apply, and if we don't like it, you're not coming.
Which brings us to the media environment inside China. Because the entry question is really the border control side of the same impulse.
Let's define what we're actually talking about. When people say media environment in China, they're usually imagining something like Pravda in the Soviet Union, a single state propaganda organ and nothing else. That's not what China looks like. China has thousands of media outlets, commercial ones, ones that compete for audiences, ones that break stories and do investigative work. The system is more subtle than pure propaganda.
Right, but subtle doesn't mean free. It means the controls are built into the structure rather than announced from a podium.
The structure is what matters, so you've got three layers. Layer 1, all news outlets must be licensed by the State Administration of Radio and Television or the Cyberspace Administration. No unlicensed publishing. Layer 2, every outlet has a party committee embedded in its leadership. This is mandatory by law since 2016, when Xi Jinping formalized the requirement that all news organizations have party leadership corps. Layer 3, the content itself is subject to pre-publication review on sensitive topics and post-publication punishment if you get it wrong.
Getting it wrong means what, exactly?
It means deviating from the approved narrative on any of the redline topics. Tibet, Xinjiang, Hong Kong, Taiwan, the Tiananmen Square crackdown, the leadership's legitimacy, the party's historical role. Those are the obvious ones. But there are also situational red lines. During the 2022 Shanghai lockdown, reporters were told not to publish stories about food shortages or people dying because they couldn't get medical care. Some did anyway, and were punished.
What kind of punishment are we talking about?
Could be your outlet gets a call from the Cyberspace Administration telling you to take something down. Could be your editor gets summoned for tea, which is the euphemism for a dressing down at the local PSB office. Could be your publication gets shut down for rectification for a few weeks. Could be individual journalists lose their press credentials. Could be criminal charges if what you published is deemed to threaten national security.
How often does the criminal part actually happen?
It's not the default, but it's not rare either. The Committee to Protect Journalists ranks China as one of the world's worst jailers of journalists. As of late 2025, they counted at least 43 journalists and media workers imprisoned in China. That includes people like Zhang Zhan, the citizen journalist who reported from Wuhan during the early COVID outbreak. She got 4 years for picking quarrels and provoking trouble. It includes Huang Shuaqin, who was a former editor at Caixin, one of China's most respected business magazines, and got 12 years in 2021 for subversion.
Caixin is interesting because it's the example people always point to when they want to say, see, China does have real journalism, and they do publish tough stories about corporate fraud, environmental disasters, local government corruption.
They do, and that's not fake. Caixin has broken major stories, the vaccine scandal in 2018, the financial shenanigans at Evergrande, the banking collapses in Hainan. But, and this is the crucial distinction, they operate entirely within the boundaries the party sets. They don't touch the red line topics. They don't question the party's right to rule. They function as a pressure release valve within the system. Expose corruption in a provincial government? That makes the central party leadership look like the cleanup crew. Question whether the system itself is the problem. That's where the line is.
It's the Fox News of authoritarianism. Hold the local officials accountable. Never touch the throne.
That's a bit glib, but the structural insight is right. The system can tolerate, even encourage, a certain amount of media aggression toward lower-level power because it reinforces the idea that the center is virtuous and the problems are all local implementation failures. What it cannot tolerate is the suggestion that the problems are systemic or that the party's leadership is the root cause.
That distinction is invisible to most Western observers, which is why you get these periodic, actually Chinese media is freer than you think, takes that completely miss the architecture.
The architecture is everything. Let me give you a concrete example of how it works in practice. In 2023, there was a terrible building collapse in Changsha. A residential building just folded, 53 people died. Chinese media covered it extensively. Reporters were on the scene, they interviewed survivors, they investigated the construction company, they found that the building had been illegally modified. All of that was published. What wasn't published was any analysis of why illegal construction is so endemic in Chinese cities, because that would lead you to the incentives created by the land finance model, which is how local governments fund themselves, which is a party policy decision.
You can describe the corpse, but not the murder weapon.
And the reporters know this. They internalize it. Most of them don't need a censor standing over their shoulder because they've been trained. Through journalism school, through the party committee in their newsroom, through watching what happens to colleagues who step over the line, to know exactly where the boundary is. It's self-censorship as a professional survival skill.
Which is in some ways more effective than having a guy with a red pen in every newsroom.
Much more effective, because then the system doesn't look repressive. It looks like professionalism. It looks like responsible journalism. And the reporters can tell themselves, probably sincerely, that they're doing real journalism, because within the permitted space, they are. The question is, who drew the space and what's outside it?
Let's talk about the internet side of this, because that's where most Chinese people actually get their information. The media environment isn't just professional newsrooms.
Right, and this is where the sophistication of the control system really shows. China has built what's essentially a parallel internet. The Great Firewall is the famous part, blocking foreign sites, VPN throttling, DNS poisoning. But that's actually the least interesting layer. The more important layer is domestic content moderation at a scale that's genuinely hard to comprehend.
Give me numbers!
The Cyberspace Administration of China, the CAC, employs, directly and through contractors, somewhere north of 2 million content moderators. These are people whose job is to review posts on Weibo, WeChat, Douyin, that's TikTok's Chinese version, and remove anything that violates content guidelines. In 2023, the CAC reported removing over 140 million pieces of harmful information from Chinese platforms in a single year. That's not a typo, 140 million.
Harmful information is defined how?
The official categories are things like rumors, pornography, violence, terrorism. But the operational definition expands and contracts based on political needs. During the 2022 protests against the zero COVID policy, the ones where people held up blank pieces of paper, which was an extraordinary moment, the definition of rumor suddenly included any post expressing frustration with lockdowns, any post sharing information about where protests were happening, any post that used certain keywords. The platforms were scrubbed in real time.
The blank paper thing is fascinating as a case study, because it showed the limits of keyword filtering. There's no keyword for holding up a blank piece of paper. The symbolism was entirely contextual.
The system adapted within hours. They started removing images that were just white rectangles. They flagged posts with no text. They temporarily suspended the ability to post images on Weibo in certain regions. What that tells you is that the moderation system isn't just a static filter, it has rapid response capabilities. When something novel emerges, the CAC issues guidance to the platforms, and the platforms update their moderation rules immediately.
The platforms comply because...
Because the alternative is being shut down. Every major Chinese internet platform has a party committee embedded in it. The CEOs of Tencent, Alibaba, ByteDance, they all sit in party congresses. Jack Ma learned this lesson publicly in 2020 when he gave that speech criticizing regulators and then vanished for months. Alibaba got hit with an antitrust fine of $2.8 billion. The message was received by everyone.
The tech CEOs are functionally party cadres with stock options.
That's exactly what they are. And they understand that their continued existence depends on cooperation. The CAC has the power to pull an app from all Chinese app stores with a single notice. They've done it. They did it to Didi, the ride-hailing giant, in 2021, right after Didi went public on the New York Stock Exchange without getting prior approval for the listing. The app was gone within 48 hours. Didi lost billions in market value.
That brings us back to the foreign journalist question, because the same logic applies. You can come to China and report, but you exist at the pleasure of the state, and that pleasure can be withdrawn without warning or explanation.
There was a case in 2024 that illustrates this perfectly. A correspondent for a major European newspaper, I want to say it was Le Monde, but I'd need to double check, had been in Beijing for 3 years. Respected, careful, did everything by the book. Published a piece about the Uyghur forced labor allegations that quoted some leaked government documents. Within 2 weeks, his press credential was not renewed and he was given 30 days to leave the country. The foreign ministry spokesman was asked about it at a press conference and said, and this is a direct quote, China welcomes foreign journalists who abide by Chinese laws and regulations. The implication being, of course, that this journalist hadn't.
Abide by Chinese laws and regulations is doing a lot of work there, because the laws and regulations are deliberately vague enough to mean whatever the government wants them to mean at any given moment.
That's the feature, not the bug. The national security law, the counter-espionage law, the cybersecurity law, all of them contain provisions that can be interpreted to cover journalistic activity. The counter-espionage law, which was revised and expanded in 2023, now defines espionage so broadly that it could theoretically include any foreign entity gathering information in China. The official text says espionage includes obtaining state secrets or intelligence through various means. What's a state secret? The state secrets law defines it as information that could harm national security or interests if disclosed. It's circular.
It's circular by design. You can't know if something is a state secret until you're charged with revealing one.
In 2023, the Ministry of State Security, the MSS, launched a public campaign encouraging citizens to report suspected spies. They put up posters, they ran social media campaigns, they set up a hotline. The campaign specifically mentioned foreign journalists and consultants as categories of people citizens should be vigilant about. This was reported by the Associated Press at the time.
It's not just that the state is watching foreign journalists. It's that the state is encouraging ordinary citizens to watch foreign journalists and report them.
Which creates an environment where any interaction between a foreign reporter and a Chinese citizen is potentially dangerous for the citizen. If you're a Chinese academic and a foreign journalist wants to talk to you about labor conditions, you have to weigh the risk that someone reports the conversation, and then you're getting a visit from the MSS. The chilling effect is enormous.
Let me pull on a thread here. You mentioned earlier that the system has gotten more restrictive under Xi Jinping. Can you put some historical texture on that? Because when I was younger, and I'm a sloth, so younger covers a lot of ground. There was a period when people thought China was slowly liberalizing.
That period was real, or at least it felt real. In the 2000s, especially after China joined the WTO in 2001, there was a genuine opening in the media space. Southern Weekly, a newspaper based in Guangzhou, did aggressive investigative reporting. They published a famous editorial in 2013 called The Chinese Dream, The Dream of Constitutionalism, which essentially argued that China needed rule of law and constitutional government. That editorial got through because there was still space for that kind of argument within the party.
Then what happened?
Xi Jinping happened. He became General Secretary in 2012, and by 2013, the crackdown on Southern Weekly had begun. The editorial staff who pushed that constitutionalism piece were purged. The paper was brought firmly under party control, and that was the template for everything that followed. Under Xi, the party's control over media has become more centralized, more ideological, and less tolerant of any deviation. The phrase people use is, the party commands the gun. The party also commands the pen. That's actually a Mao quote, but Xi has revived it and made it operational.
It's not just domestic media. The external propaganda apparatus has expanded massively too.
China Global Television Network, CGTN, that's the English language state broadcaster. It's got bureaus in Nairobi, in London, in Washington. Its budget has increased something like tenfold since 2013. The idea is to project Chinese soft power and counter what the party calls Western media hegemony. But CGTN is not independent journalism. It's a state propaganda organ. Its staff in Beijing are party members. Its coverage of China is relentlessly positive. Its coverage of Western countries, particularly the United States, focuses relentlessly on crime, racism, political dysfunction. It's the mirror image of what Chinese media does domestically.
The Chinese media environment, seen from 30,000 feet, is a dual system. Domestically, you have tightly controlled but commercially viable outlets that can do real reporting within a bounded space. Internationally, you have a state-funded propaganda network designed to shape foreign perceptions, and connecting them is a legal and surveillance apparatus that enforces the boundaries.
The two are connected strategically. The domestic control prevents Chinese citizens from accessing alternative narratives. The international propaganda provides an alternative narrative for foreign audiences. The goal is to create a world where the party's version of reality is the only version available to Chinese citizens, and a plausible competitor to Western narratives for everyone else.
Which raises the question, does it work? Is the Chinese public actually convinced?
It's complicated. Survey research inside China is difficult because people are afraid to give honest answers to political questions. But there's a Harvard study. The Ash Center did a series of surveys between 2003 and 2016 that found satisfaction with the central government was consistently above 90%. The caveats are obvious. People may not be truthful to surveyors. The questions may be framed in ways that elicit positive responses, and satisfaction with government services isn't the same as support for authoritarianism. But it's also true that the party has delivered real material improvements for hundreds of millions of people. If you went from subsistence farming to a middle-class urban lifestyle in one generation, you might feel that the system works.
The media environment reinforces that. If every news story you see is about corrupt local officials being punished by a virtuous central government, and you never see stories questioning whether the system itself is the problem, the narrative coheres.
It coheres until it doesn't. The zero COVID protests in 2022 were a crack in that coherence. People were angry, and they expressed that anger publicly, and the government's response was not to engage with the substance of the anger, but to suppress the expression of it. The protests ended, the lockdowns ended, but the underlying question, what happens when the system stops delivering material improvements, hasn't been answered.
The media environment is designed to prevent that question from being asked publicly.
And that's the connection back to the visa question. The same impulse that leads the party to control what Chinese citizens can read and say leads it to control which foreigners can enter the country. It's all about information management. If you've criticized the party, you are a vector for information the party doesn't want circulating, so you're denied entry. The system treats ideas the way other countries treat infectious diseases.
Quarantine for wrongthink.
Like any quarantine, it's imperfect. Chinese citizens find ways around the Great Firewall. Foreign ideas seep in through cracked apps and smuggled documents. The party knows it can't achieve perfect control. The goal isn't perfection, it's containment. Keep the alternative narratives marginal enough that they don't threaten the system's stability.
Let me ask about the trajectory. We've established that things got tighter under Xi. Is there any sign of loosening, or is this the new normal?
Everything I've seen suggests this is the new normal, and possibly a baseline that will keep tightening. The 2023 revision of the counter-espionage law, the expansion of the MSS's domestic surveillance role, the integration of AI into content moderation, all of these point toward more control, not less. The party has concluded, I think, that the relative openness of the 2000s was a mistake. It allowed too many dangerous ideas to circulate. The current leadership sees information control as essential to regime survival.
They're not entirely wrong from their perspective. The Soviet Union lost the information war. The Chinese Communist Party studied that collapse carefully and concluded that Gorbachev's glasnost was suicide.
That's exactly the lesson they drew. There's a famous internal party document from the early 2000s, the 8 lessons from the collapse of the Soviet Union, that explicitly identifies media liberalization as one of the key factors that brought down the USSR. It says, and I'm paraphrasing, that the Soviet media became a tool for anti-communist forces because the party lost control of the narrative. The Chinese party is determined not to make the same mistake.
We're looking at a media environment that is the product of deliberate strategic choices informed by historical analysis, not just paranoid authoritarianism. It's authoritarianism with a theory of the case.
That's what makes it so durable. This isn't a system lurching from crisis to crisis, slapping down dissent as it pops up. It's a system designed from first principles to manage the information environment in a way that preserves one-party rule. Every element, the licensing requirements, the embedded party committees, the pre-publication review, the post-publication punishment, the Great Firewall, the content moderation army, the visa blacklists, fits together into a coherent architecture.
The architecture metaphor is good. It's a building designed for a specific purpose, and every beam and bolt serves that purpose. The fact that it's oppressive doesn't mean it's poorly constructed.
And that's what I think many Western observers miss. They look at Chinese media and see censorship, and they assume it's clumsy and unsustainable. But it's not clumsy, it's sophisticated. And it's sustained by a leadership that believes it's necessary for national survival.
To answer the prompt directly, can foreigners who've criticized the CCP visit China? The answer is sometimes, but not reliably, and the more prominent your criticism, the less likely you are to get in. The system is opaque, there's no appeals process, and the definition of criticism that triggers exclusion is expanding.
The media environment inside China is a tightly managed ecosystem where professional journalism exists but operates within boundaries that are enforced through structural controls, legal threats, and a pervasive culture of self-censorship. It's not Pravda. It's more sophisticated than that, but it's absolutely not free.
The sophistication is almost the most unsettling part. A clumsy propaganda system would be easier to dismiss. This one is good enough that you can consume Chinese media for years and not notice what's missing unless you're actively looking for it.
That's the art of it. The absence is the message, but the absence is invisible.
Which is a good place to leave the media side. One last thing on the visa question. Is there any recourse? Can a journalist who's been blacklisted ever get off the list?
There's no formal process. Anecdotally, there are cases where someone who was denied a visa eventually got one after years of silence. No further criticism, no public commentary on China. The implicit bargain is, prove you're no longer a threat and maybe we'll let you in, but there's no guarantee and there's no way to know where you stand.
The door isn't permanently locked, but there's no handle on your side.
The lock is in a room you can't enter. That's the system.
I think we've covered the ground. Let's see what Hilbert has for us today.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1720s, beekeepers near Lake Baikal noticed that bees imported from Western Russia performed waggle dances that local Siberian bees couldn't interpret. The two populations had developed what amounted to different dance dialects, and the Siberian bees kept flying off in wrong directions, while the newcomer bees starved because nobody would follow their directions. It was an accidental experiment in apian language barriers, conducted entirely by confused insects.
Even bees have regional accents and immigration problems.
That's going to sit with me.
This has been My Weird Prompts, episode 201. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you're enjoying the show, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.